All right, good morning, everyone. Nathan Collier, and we're continuing our study of The Battle Belongs to the Lord, a study of biblical warfare in the Bible. For those of you who maybe your first time or maybe you missed one, a quick recap. A couple weeks ago, we did an introduction to warfare in the Bible. We looked at weaponry. We looked at tactics. We kind of just gave a, kind of set our minds of what it is we're talking about. 86 times in the Old Testament, it talks about some type of warfare or conflict or victory. 86 times. And all that's front-loaded of the first 17 books of the Bible, 12 of those mention warfare. It is foundational to the story of God, to the foundation of the Israelite people, to the beginning of the Bible. The Torah books there at the beginning, and then the Pentateuch, those early books, those history, are very heavy and rich in warfare. And when we study warfare in schools and universities, a lot of times history is defined by wars. So that's why we're taking a look at it here this summer. Last week, we talked about offensive operations. We talked about two periods in the Israelite nation, early on with Joshua when they entered the land of Canaan and took the offensive, and then later on, King David, during the time of the Bronze Age collapse, when all of kind of the normal way of life with these big powerhouses that reigned in the Mediterranean area, the Middle East, they all started to kind of crumble. There was a big power imbalance. And during that time, David was able to stand up and kind of rise Israel to its peak. Two times where Israel was on the offense, fighting for the Lord, and was able to achieve a lot. Today, we're going to look at defensive operations. So let's get started. This is from, so what we're doing is we're mixing in army doctrine, we're mixing in history, and of course the Bible, right? So this is from U.S. Army Field Manual 3.0. I'm an army guy, still in, so I like to talk army stuff, and I like the Bible. So Army FM 3.0. A defensive task is a task conducted to defeat an enemy attack, gain time, economize forces, and develop conditions favorable for offensive or stability tasks. Normally, the defense cannot achieve a decisive victory. However, it sets conditions for a counteroffensive or a counterattack that enables forces to regain the initiative. That middle sentence right there. Defense cannot achieve a decisive victory. What's the point of the defense? To transition back to what? The offense. It's not to stay in the defense and hope everything turns out all right. It's to transition back to the offense, transition back to a counterattack. This is foundational for our discussion today. Alfred Thayer Mahan was a very influential naval officer who went on to be a historian here in the U.S., very influential in warfare, in his writings and doctrine. And he said, in war, the defense exists mainly that the offense may act more freely. The defense is there for what? The offense. Okay? So for those of us, we talked in offense, or in our first lesson, we talked about battles. We talked about the battle belongs to the Lord. What battle are you personally fighting? Last week with the offense, we talked about offensive campaigns. A campaign is a string of battles. And we looked at the Israelite nation during those two periods. And during campaigns, you're not always undefeated. You win some and you lose some, but over the course of that campaign comes out a victory, right? In a campaign, there's an offense and there's a defense. And I don't mean like sports where the offensive field's on the team and the defensive field's on the team and you're one or the other. As you are marching along in life, in a campaign, in a fight, in a war, there's times when you need to be on the offense, and there's times where you need to pull back and be in the defense. There's a time and a place for both. And the discernment of when that is very important. You need to pull in the defense so that your offense can act more freely. A little bit of a recap, something very foundational I want you to continue to keep in your mind. This is the Israelites on the left. We should have named him at the beginning or something. But here's our buddy. They don't have a lot. It's a tribe. They came out of slavery. They wandered in the desert for 40 years. They start winning some victories and defeating some people. But in the Bible, it specifically says they burned it all. They defeated people that had superior weaponry, superior armor. They had chariots and horses. They didn't take it. They left it because the Lord told them to. These were people wandering in the desert with sandals, a little cloth dress, and they didn't have special training. They just went out there, and as I say, they were fighting on faith. Canaanites on the left, this is very representative of a lot of the, whether it's Philistines or Assyrians or Egyptians, their armor looked very similar, a little bit of difference here and there, but it was armor, it was shields, it was metallurgy, it was metal swords, it was horses and chariots, higher mobility, better trained soldiers. But the Israelites, when they were in the offense, were able to win. Here's a depiction of what warfare would have looked like in the time. Once again, Israelites scrapping. Okay, so let's do a quick rehash. Joshua entering the land of Canaan, finally getting to the land that God had promised them. You see that kind of circle with the blue arrow? They're crossing over the Jordan River. They finally enter the land of Canaan. They turn south into a southern offensive campaign, have success, defeat some kings, burn and destroy these villages. They turn north, go up, turn and destroy a bunch of stuff in the northern campaign, and they finally settle where God had promised them. To Texas size this area, it's the size of New Jersey. Israel's the size of New Jersey, but for Texas reasons, if you took every county that touches Erath County and then add in Brown County, Brownwood, and Parker County, that's about the size of Israel. So that's what that's what the size of Israel looks like in Texas. And we talked about terrain a little last week. We're going to rehash that now. When they moved in to the land of Canaan, the Israelites ended up taking, and they refer to it several times in the Old Testament, as the hill country. It's the hilly, mountainous terrain you see here, kind of on the left, the east and the west of the Jordan River, Sea of Galilee. That there's that flat coastal plain there where it's where a lot of the trade happened and a lot of the routes of people moving in. This was a very important part because it connected Egypt all the way up into modern-day Iraq, Euphrates and Tigris and things like that, and up into Europe and Asia. This was an important route. A lot of trade goods came through here. The Israelites were living here, but as we'll see here in a minute, they didn't control it. They lived there, but they didn't control it. Kind of back to our counties in Texas, they were living in Erath County, they're living in Comanche County, they're living down in Brown County, but they don't control 377. They don't control 281. They don't control Highway 6. They're in and around the area, but they don't own it. Another important part here, you kind of see this little excerpt. This is Jezreel Valley. The coastal plain is a major north-south route. This is the point where this very wide, fertile, flat valley is where that trade route, the valley cuts east to west, which allows that trade to cross over the Jordan and continue more kind of inland continent area. So the Israel nation here, we're about to see a map in a minute, is south of this valley and also north of this valley. But like I said, here's a map. Here's where the 12 tribes kind of settled out, where we'll be reading about today. You kind of see it covering the whole area. You see it north of the Jezreel Valley. You see it all the way out to the coastal plain. But like I said earlier, they were in this area, but they didn't control the major routes. Okay. So this is where we picked it up. Joshua's, they've come in, they've had their campaigns, they've taken the land that God has promised them. We're jumping into Judges chapter 2. As I've titled this, this is not what the Bible calls it, but I've titled it Complacency in Canaan. Judges chapter 2, verse 1. Angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochum and said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you in the land I swore to give you to your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land. But you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? And I have also said, I will not drive them out before you. They will become traps for you, and their gods will become snares to you. Skipping ahead to verse 8. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. And they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gesh. After the whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served Baals. They forsake the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshiped various gods and peoples around them. They aroused the Lord's anger because they had forsaken him and served Baal and the Asherahs. In his anger against Israel, the Lord gave them into the hands of the raiders who plundered them. He sold them into their hands of their enemies all around, whom they no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the Lord of the hand of God was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to their gods and worshiped them. They quickly turned from their ways of their ancestors who had been obedient to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord relented because of their groaning under those who oppressed them and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to their ways even more corrupt than those of their ancestors. Following their other gods and serving and worshiping them, they refused to give their evil practices and stubborn ways. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant I ordained to their ancestors and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and whether they keep their way of the Lord and walk as their ancestors did. Beginning of chapter 3. These are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any wars in Canaan. He did this only to teach warfare to descendants of the Israelites who had not had previous battle experience. The five rulers of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, the Hivites, living in the Lebanon mountains, from Mount Baal Hermon to Lebo Hamath. They were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's commands, which he had given their ancestors through Moses. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, and Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. Israelites got complacent during this time, the time of the judges. So we have the tribe on the left. They come in, they're fighting for existence, fighting to establish their life. This is that earlier generation we're talking about in Judges. And for this 300-year period in the time of Judges, we just read in detail of what they're doing. They're falling away from the Lord. They're mixing with, marrying and intermixing with these tribes. The Lord told them to go in and to push them all out, to get rid of all of them. They didn't do it. And they became snares. And they continually hung up the Israelite people. And the earlier generation, or the later generations, didn't know what it was like to fight for God, to fight for a grip against the world. They were born and raised in kind of an established land. And you continue to see this cycle, as predicted here. The cycle, Israel serves the Lord. Israel falls into sin and idolatry. Israel is enslaved. Israel cries out to the Lord. God raises up a judge. Israel's delivered, and the cycle repeats. What Israel's doing here is they're fighting a defensive war. They're trying to hold on to what God has given them. And when danger comes and things don't go their way, a judge raises up, takes care of the threat, they get complacent again, and then they go back to ways of the world. I would say that this happens in our own life. We're trying to hold on. We feel like in life we're just trying to hold on. We get complacent. God has blessed us all. And then a disaster comes, an emergency comes, and we talk, oh God, I need you. Church, I need you. And whether it, God, through the aid of our community or through the aid of our church, people come, they wrap their arms around us, we get relief, we feel blessed, and then we get back into the ways of the world. We get complacent, and then another emergency comes. God, I need you. Church, I need you. I would say we're not much different than the Israelites. Are we living in the offense? Or are we trying to hold on to what God has given us? This is what we read last week. General Clausewitz, Prussian general. On no account should we overlook the moral effect of a rapidly running assault. It hardens the advancing soldier against danger, while the stationary soldier loses his presence of mind. What was Israelites doing? Were they rapidly advancing and assaulting on behalf of the name of the Lord? Or were they sitting, losing their presence of mind during the time of Judges? They were sitting. They were losing their presence of mind. They weren't hardened against danger in Judges. We're going to look at a couple of historical examples of the defense. And that's the great thing about studying warfare and history. A lot of the truths can be driven out of just pick the time period. And it's definitely applicable today. The Maginot Line. Someone tell me where the Maginot Line is. France. All right. Of course, the history teacher. Should have told him not to answer. Maginot Line is in France. This is one of the marvels of engineering, of warfare engineering. 10 years between World War I and World War II, the French spent, I think it was in today's dollars, $4 billion to create a defensive wall between the French, the border of France and Germany. $4 billion, 10 years. Look at the size of these gun turrets, artillery positions. They didn't just dig in these like little pillboxes. They built, look in the lower right, entire fortifications with like chow halls, housing. This was mega engineering operations, 10 years. Let me read off some stats to you. 142 forts. That's like underground living quarters and stuff. 352 gun emplacements, 147 artillery emplacements, 78 shelters, 17 observatories, 5,000 stronghouses. These are like fortified little houses that were made to look like farmhouses, but actually had some underground bunkers into them and were hardened. They were houses to look like houses, but were actually fighting positions. 5,000 stronghouses, 62 miles of underground tunnels. One of the most amazing engineering construction projects with warfare. The total length was 280 miles. That is from Stephenville, Texas to downtown Houston. Amazing to build a defense, to hold on to what you got, to not be on the offense, but to simply just try to keep out the world, keep out the evil. Amazing. One of the biggest examples of defensive effort in the history of mankind. Germany invades. Listen to this. Germany invades May 10th. Paris falls June 14th. What? 10 years in preparation. Paris falls in a little over a month. What happened? How did the Germans overcome the most fortified, impressive, impenetrable defense mankind has ever seen. They went around it. They went around it. That's it. They avoided it. They sent a little bit of an offense to kind of, as a feint, to kind of show that they were attacking. They went around it. They went through Belgium. In life, we can build the... Yes, sir. He was... Yep, should have been pointed all north to the neutral neighbor. In life, we can build the biggest wall we possibly can. As a parent, as a young parent, I can do all that I can to try to protect my kids from the world. But you can't. You can put in just unbelievable effort. Sin's just going to come around the corner. Are we living in the defense and just trying to survive? Or are we on the offense, pushing at the enemy, attacking at the enemy? Great example here, the Maginot Line. In offense, so we're talking about the offense. In offensive operations, commanders look for gaps or weaknesses in enemy defenses. They study enemy defensive preparations and direct actions to obstruct and frustrate them. They plan to penetrate enemy security areas, overcome obstacles, avoid enemy strengths, and destroy the coherence of the defense. Success requires an active, responsive, intelligent effort oriented on critical units and areas. At times when the Israelites were pushing and fighting, even though they didn't have the right equipment, even though they didn't have the training, God was on their side and he guaranteed them victory. At times where they were sitting on their hands, living in the ways of the world, they were overrun. They couldn't handle it. How are we living our life? We looked at this picture last week. This is the fall of Samaria. This is after the time of David and Solomon, but it's a depiction of the Israelite people when their nations were broken up and enslaved. I think it's a good depiction of Christianity holding on to something and letting the world, just trying to keep the world out. Is that how we are living? We'll look at a couple more historical examples moving through time of the defense. To the people of Texas, all Americans in the world, fellow citizens and compatriots, I besieged by 1,000 or more Mexicans under Santa Anna. I have sustained a continual bombardment and cannonade for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded a surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrisons are to be put to the sword. If the fort is taken, I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat. Then I call on you in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character to come to our aid with all dispatch. The enemy is receiving reinforcements daily and will no doubt increase to 3,000 or 4,000 in 4 or 5 days. If this call is neglected, I am determined to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due to his own honor and that of his country, victory or death. Lieutenant Colonel William B. Travis at the Alamo, February 24th, 1836. We all know the story of the Alamo. It's a great story, very true and dear to a Texan's heart, right? But they lost. They all died. Did the Alamo win victory for Texas? No, but what did it do? What happened later? General Sam Houston, San Jacinto, the offense, won Texas's independence, won the victory. The defense allowed for what? The offense, the time, allowed for the offense. The offense is what wins. As great a story as the Alamo is, and as great as their sacrifice was, it helped win Texas's independence. But what ultimately won was not the defense. It allowed for what? The offense. One more historical example. Fortress Graham Street. The defense is absolutely necessary in fighting campaigns. But are we on the offense? Is this fortress here to protect us from the world and hope to hold on to all that we have and hope that we can hold out the world until the end? Or is it here for what warfare means for the defense? A defensive task. This is a quote from Army FM 30 that we looked at the very beginning. A defensive task is a task conducted to defeat an enemy attack, gain time, economize forces, and develop conditions favorable for the offense. In our life, in our faith campaign, there's times where we need to be on the offense and need to be on the defense. Is this church? I feel that churches are great places for a defense. They come in to get fellowship with fellow believers, to feel safe. But are we using Graham Street to launch offensive operations, to prepare our congregants to go and take God into the world? Or is Graham Street trying to just hold on to what the Lord has given us? Some closing comments. I'd like to open up for discussion. I know I've been doing a lot of talking over these last few weeks. I really wanted to dive in and provide some context and material. I know the warfare aspect and the parallels is kind of new to a lot of people. But this is kind of the depiction I want to talk about. We've talked for weeks now about the Israelites didn't have a lot. They were fighting on faith. They're not armored. They don't have chariots. They don't have the best equipment. They are fighting on faith. They are launching out at times. And the Lord said, I'll carry you. The battle belongs to me. I will deliver you. Or are we in an Alamo? Have we built an Alamo? Are we simply holding on till the very end? How are we living our lives? Campaigns consist of highs and lows, of wins and losses. There's time for an offense and there's time for a defense. But I would take a self-reflection as us as individuals and us as a church. What kind of offensive operation are we living? Finished a little bit early this week. I wanted to open up for any discussion or comments. So from the soldier perspective, I think one of the great things the military does is it paints a common goal of what it is they're driving towards. And all efforts from bases scattered across the world are driving towards common end states. They know what's expected and they know why they're showing up and working hard and training every day. I think at times, Christianity, through different denominations and different churches scattered across communities, I think the common effort piece is lost because of generational goals. Me as a young father, my kids are a huge priority. As an older grandparent, you're not showing up to church, making sure that your six-year-old is getting taught well. I think some churches have different focuses on whether their influence is the community, or whether it's international missions, or whether it's just serving those inside the building. I think a lot of times what's lost today is what are we here for? What is the common goal? When you have 60 different little goals, it's hard to unite efforts. Any other? Yes, sir.
It's a blessing to walk in here today and hear about offense, because so many times I think many of us get stuck on the defense and we get complacent, just like Israelites do. The enemy's always on the offense. The enemy back there, he's not right in front of your face. He's sitting back there, but it's not about to take it. And I think that's really important to remember, and I'm so thankful to walk in today and remember to stay on the offense and see the enemy doesn't take it.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for being here too. It's good to see your good to see your face. Yes, sir. Yeah, they'll find the chink in the armor. Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
I think sometimes we forget about they laid everything on the line. Nothing was held back in their fight to do what the Lord had asked them to do. They were willing to lose it all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think modern era has taught us the opposite of that. We're all worried, sick about things that really don't matter.
Mm-hmm. Are we fighting on faith? Fighting on faith means you honestly don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. Are you putting yourself outside of that comfort zone and really, truly relying on the Lord to deliver you? We learned about the Israelites, and that younger generation didn't know what it was like to fight. Let's be honest. I know there are certain individuals in here like myself who have served and fought. But as we as a nation, have we had to fight for religious freedom? No. We've all been raised very privileged in one of the greatest nations, one of the greatest economies, one of the greatest pillars of democracy in the history of the world. We have all been blessed in a great place, at a time where we didn't know what it was like to have to fight. So how much are we like that second generation in the land of Canaan that doesn't know warfare, doesn't know what it's like to have to fight for God? Are we comfortable with our worldly possessions that are so important to us, and we're holding on to those and not willing to step out in faith because of the comfort that we have, just like we read about in the book of Judges? Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. Any other comments or questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Good to see you, Jake. Good to see your face. Anything else? Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. She talked about how living on faith is both in the offense and in the defense. There's times where you need to believe in God that he can deliver you, both when you're active in the offense and when you're sitting back in the defense just trying to collect yourself and regain your composure. Doubt.
Doubt is necessary.
Mm-hmm. But is it followed by?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Being outside that comfort zone once again. Yep. Pushing yourself to where you are doubting, and then the Lord delivers you. Because we know he did that with the Israelites, Jericho and other times. The lion's den. I bet you there was a lot of those characters or the stories we read, but there was a lot of doubt in their minds, but the Lord delivered them. Absolutely. Yes, sir, right here. Love is absolutely foundational to what God talks about. And just to take what you said a little bit further, but in today's society, you rewind 50, 60 years ago, whatever the time frame was, most communities, especially here in the Bible Belt, were in a church. They were in a pew like this on Sunday morning. Today, society has changed. Our focus can't just be here in the walls, because the people aren't here on Sunday. They're at home. They're out at kids' sporting events. They're out at the lake. They're not here. If we want the world to hear God, we got to take it outside the walls. We got to be on the offense. Absolutely. Anything else? Jake. Absolutely, Jake. All right, we'll close today with a prayer. Thank you all for coming. Please pray with me. Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you so much for this church. Thank you so much for the people here today and the members of this church. But Lord, thank you for your church across the world. Please help us to continue to keep our eyes on you and what it is that you have tasked us to do in this world. Help us to carry your guide on forward, to push the name of the name of the Lord and your word into this world, and to shed light where there is darkness. Lord, there are so many people among us and around us that need you, that need your love and need your grace. I pray that this church is a place of refuge for those who are hurt and wounded. But Lord, I pray that this church also equips us with the shield and the sword and the armor necessary to go out and boldly deliver your name and your saving grace to this world and this community. Please help us to live on the offense. Please harden us against the danger and help us to make a change in this world. It's in your name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much for being here today.